kind of relief. This thing with Jennifer Sterling had become strangely disorienting. He would never normally have spent so much time and energy on a woman whose passion was not a foregone conclusion. The thought of not seeing her again was upsetting, but some part of him wanted to return to his old routines, to rediscover the person he was. He pulled a suitcase from the rack and placed it on his bed. He would pack, and then he would send her a note, thanking her for her time and suggesting that if she ever wanted to meet for lunch in London, she should telephone him. If she chose to contact him there, away from the magic of this place, perhaps she would become like all of the others, a pleasant physical diversion. It was as he put his shoes into the case that the call came from the concierge. A woman was waiting in reception for him.
Blonde hair?
Yes, sir.
Would you mind asking her to come to the telephone?
He heard a brief burst of French, then her voice, a little breathless, uncertain. It's Jennifer. I just wondered if we might have a quick drink.
Delighted, but I'm not quite ready. Do you want to come up and wait?
He tidied his room rapidly, kicking stray items under the bed. He rearranged the sheet of paper in his typewriter, as if he'd been working on the piece he had wired across an hour earlier. He pulled on a clean shirt, although he didn't have time to do it up. When he heard a soft knock, he opened the door.
"What a lovely surprise," he said. "I was just finishing something, but do come in."
She stood awkwardly in the corridor. When she caught sight of his bare chest, she looked away. "Would you rather I waited downstairs?"
"No, please. I'll only be a few minutes."
She stepped in and walked to the centre of the room. She was wearing a pale gold sleeveless dress with a mandarin collar. Her shoulders were slightly pink where the sun had touched them as she drove. Her hair was loose around her shoulders, a little wind-blown, as if she had driven there in a hurry. Her gaze took in the bed, littered with notepads, the near-packed suitcase. They were briefly silenced by proximity. She recovered first. "Aren't you going to offer me a drink?"
"Sorry, inconsiderate of me."
He telephoned down for a gin and tonic, which arrived in minutes.
"Where are we going?"
"Going?
Have I time to shave?"
He went into the bathroom. "Of course. Go ahead." He had done this on purpose, he thought afterwards, made her party to the enforced intimacy. He looked better. The sick man's yellow pallor had left his skin. The lines of strain had been ironed from his eyes. He ran the hot water and watched her in the bathroom mirror as he lathered his chin. She was distracted, preoccupied. As his razor scraped against his skin, he watched her pace like a restless animal.
"Are you all right?"
he called, rinsing his blade in the water. "I'm fine." She had drunk half the gin and tonic already and poured another. He finished shaving, toweled dry his face, splashed on some of the aftershave he had bought from the pharmacie. It was sharp, with notes of citrus and rosemary. He did up his shirt and straightened his collar in the mirror. He loved this moment, the convergence of appetite and possibility. He felt oddly triumphant. He stepped out of the bathroom and found her standing by the balcony. The sky was dimming, the lights of the seafront glowing as dusk fell. She held her drink in one hand, the other arm laid slightly defensively across her waist. He took a step closer to her.
"I forgot to say how lovely you look," he said. "I like that colour on you. It's..."
"Larry's back tomorrow." She drew away from the balcony and faced him. "I had a wire this afternoon. We'll be flying to London on Tuesday."
"I see," he said.
There were tiny blonde hairs on her arm. The sea breeze lifted and laid them down. When he looked up, her eyes locked with his. "I'm not unhappy," she said.
"I know that."
She was studying him, her lovely mouth serious. She bit her lip, then turned her back to him. She stood very still. "The top button," she said.
"I'm sorry."
"I can't undo it myself."
Something ignited inside him. He experienced it almost as relief, that this would happen, that the woman he had dreamt about, conjured at night in this bed, was to be his after all. Her distance, her resistance had almost overwhelmed him. He wanted the release that comes with release, wanted to feel spent, the ache of perpetual unrelieved desire soothed. He took her drink from her, and her hand went to her hair, lifting it from the nape of her neck. He obeyed the silent instruction, lifting his hands to her skin. Usually so certain, his fingers fumbled, were thick and clumsy. He watched them as if from afar, wrestling with the silk-covered button, and as he released it, he saw that his hands were trembling. He stilled and gazed at her neck. Exposed now, it was bent forwards slightly as if in supplication. He wanted to place his mouth on it, could already taste that pale, lightly freckled skin. His thumb rested there, tender, luxuriating in the prospect of what lay ahead. She let out a small breath at the pressure, so subtle that he felt rather than heard it. And something in him stalled. He stared at the down where her golden hair met her skin, at the slender fingers still holding it up, and he understood with horrible certainty what was going to happen. Anthony O'Hare closed his eyes very tightly, and then, with exquisite deliberation, he refastened her dress. He took a small step backwards. She hesitated, as if she was trying to work out what he had done, perhaps registering the absence of his skin on hers. Then she turned, her hand on the back of her neck, establishing what had taken place. She gazed at him, and her face, at first questioning, coloured.
"I'm sorry," he began, "but I can't."
"Oh!" She flinched. Her hand went to her mouth and a deep blush stained her neck. "Oh, God!"
"No, you don't understand, Jennifer. It's not anything that..."
She pushed past him, grabbing her handbag. And then, before he could say anything else, she was wrestling with the door handle and running down the corridor.
"Jennifer!" he yelled. "Jennifer, let me explain!"
But by the time he had reached the door, she was gone. The French train plodded through the parched countryside to Lyon, as if it was determined to grant him too long to think of all the things he had got wrong, and all the things he couldn't have changed, even if he'd wanted to. Several times an hour, he thought about ordering himself a large whiskey from the dining car. He watched the stewards move deftly up and down the carriage, carrying glasses on silver trays. A choreographed ballet of stooping and pacing, and knew it would take only the lifting of a finger to have that consolation for himself. Afterwards, he was barely sure what had prevented him doing so. At night, he settled into the couchette, pulled out with disdainful efficiency by the steward. As the train rumbled on through the darkness, he clicked on his bedside light and picked up a paperback book he had found at the hotel, left by some former traveller. He read the same page several times, took nothing in, and eventually threw it down in disgust. He had a French newspaper, but the space was too cramped to unfold the pages properly, and the print too small in the dim light. He dozed and awoke, and as England drew closer, the future settled on him like a big black cloud. Finally, as dawn broke, he found pen and paper. He had never written a letter to a woman other than brief thank-you notes to his mother for whatever small gift she had sent, and to Clarissa about financial matters, his brief apology to Jennifer after that first night. Now, consumed by an aching melancholy, haunted by the mortified look in Jennifer's eyes, freed by the prospect that he might never see her again, he wrote unguardedly, wanting only to explain himself.
"Dearest, I couldn't make you listen when you left in such a hurry. But I need you to know that I was not rejecting you. You were so far from the truth, I can hardly bear it. Here is the truth. You would not be the first married woman I have made love to. You know my personal circumstances, and to be frank, these relationships, such as they are, have suited me. I did not want to be close to anyone. When we first met, I chose to think you would be no different. It was for that reason that I redid that wretched button at your neck. And for that reason, I have lain awake for the last 2 nights, hating myself for the one decent thing I have ever done. Forgive me. B. He folded it carefully into his breast pocket, and then at last he slept. Don stubbed out his cigarette and studied the typewritten sheet, while the young man, standing awkwardly to the side of his desk, shifted from one foot to the other.
You can't spell bigamy. It's an A, not an O.
He swiped his pencil belligerently across 3 lines, and this intro's terrible. You've got a man who married 3 women called Hilda, all within 2 miles of each other. That's a gift of a story. The way you've written it, I'd rather be reading Hansard on municipal drainage.
Sorry, Mr. Franklin. Bugger sorry. Get it right. This was for an early page and it's already 4:20. What the hell is the matter with you? Bigamy? You want to take a lesson from O'Hare here? He spent so much time in Africa that we can't tell whether the bloody spellings are right or wrong anyway.
He threw the sheet of paper at the young man, who scrabbled for it and left the office quickly.
So, Don tutted, where's my bloody feature then? Riviera's Secrets of the Rich and Famous.
It's coming.
Anthony lied. You better make it quick. I've got 1/2 page put by for it on Saturday. Did you have a good time?
It was fine. Don tilted his head.
Yeah, looks like it. So, anyway, I've got good news.
The windows of his office were so covered with nicotine that anyone who brushed innocently against them would find their shirt sleeves stained yellow. Anthony stared out through the golden fog at the newsroom. For 2 days now, he'd walked around with the letter in his pocket, trying to work out how he could get it to her. He kept seeing her face, the flush of horror, as she realized what she thought had been her mistake.
Tony? Yes? I've got good news for you.
Right, yes.
I've been talking to the foreign desk and they want someone to go to Baghdad. Take a look at this man from the Polish embassy who's claiming to be some sort of super spy. Hard news, son, right up your street. It'll get you out of the office for 1 or 2 weeks.
I can't go now.
You need a day or two?
I've got some personal business to sort out.
Shall I tell the Algerians to hold off on the ceasefire, too, just in case it gets in the way of your domestic arrangements? Are you kidding me, O'Hare?
Then send someone else. I'm sorry, Don.
Don's metronomic clicking of his ballpoint pen became increasingly uneven.
I don't understand. You spend all your time hanging around the office bitching that you need to be off doing real news, so I give you a story that Peterson would gnaw his right arm off for, and all of a sudden you want to be desk-bound.
Like I said, I'm sorry.
Don's mouth fell open. He closed it, stood up heavily, made his way across the office and closed the door. Then he came back to his seat.
Tony, this is a good story. You should be all over it like a bad suit. More than that, you need this story. You need to show them they can rely on you.
He peered at him.
You lost your appetite? You telling me you want to stick with the soft stuff?
No, I'm just... Just give me a day or two.
Don sat back, lit a cigarette and inhaled noisily.
Good God, he said. It's a woman.
Anthony said nothing.
It is. You met a woman. What's the matter? You can't go anywhere until you've cracked her.
She's married.
Since when did that stop you?
She's... It's the wife. Sterling's wife.
And?
And she's too good.
For him, don't tell me.
For me. I don't know what to do.
Don raised his eyes to the ceiling.
An attack of conscience, eh? I wondered why you looked so bloody awful.
He shook his head, spoke as if someone else was in the little room.
I don't believe it. O'Hare, of all people.
He placed his pen on his desk with a chubby hand.
Okay, here's what you're going to do. Go and see her, do what you have to do, get it out of your system. Then be on the flight that leaves tomorrow lunchtime. I'll tell the desk you left this evening. How does that sound? And write me some bloody decent stories.
Get it out of your system, you old romantic.
You got a prettier phrase?
Anthony felt the letter in his pocket.
I owe you one, he said.
You owe me 83!
Don grumbled.
It had not been hard to find Stirling's address. He had scanned the office copy of Who's Who, and there it was, at the bottom of his entry, underneath Married, Jennifer Louisa Verinder, born 1934. That evening, after work, he had driven to Fitzrovia and parked in the square a few doors up from the white stuccoed house. A Nash-style Regency villa, with pillars that flanked the front porch, it had the air of an expensive consultant's office in Harley Street. He sat in the car and wondered what she was doing behind those net curtains. He pictured her sitting with a magazine, perhaps gazing blankly across the room and thinking of a lost moment in a hotel room in France. At around 6:30, a middle-aged woman left the house, drawing her coat around her and glancing up as if checking the sky for rain. She tied a waterproof bonnet over her hair and hurried down the street. The curtains were drawn by an unseen hand, and the humid evening gave way to night. But he sat in his Hillman, staring at number 32. He had begun to drift off when at last the front door opened. As he pushed himself upright, she stepped out. It was almost 9 o'clock. She was wearing a sleeveless white dress, a little wrap over her shoulders, and walked down the steps carefully as if she didn't quite trust her feet. Then Stirling was behind her, saying something that Anthony couldn't hear, and she nodded. Then they were climbing into a big black car. As it pulled out into the road, Anthony charged the ignition. He drove into the road, one car behind them, and followed. They didn't travel far. The driver paused at the door of a Mayfair casino to let them out. She straightened her dress, then walked inside, taking off her wrap as she went. Anthony waited until he was sure Stirling had gone in, then pulled his Hillman into the spot behind the black car.
"Park that for me, will you?"
he called to the incredulous doorman, threw him the keys and pressed a 10-shilling note into his hand.
"Sir, can I see your membership card?"
He was hastening through the lobby when a man in a casino uniform stopped him.
"Sir, your membership card?"
The Stirlings were about to step into the elevator. He could just see her through the crowd.
"I need to speak to someone. I'll be 2 minutes. Sir, I'm afraid I can't let you in without..."
Anthony reached into his pocket and pulled out everything in it. Wallet, house keys, passport, and dumped it into the man's open hands.
"Take it. Take it all. I promise I'll only be 2 minutes."
And as the man stared, open-mouthed, he pushed his way through the crowd and edged into the lift as the doors closed. Stirling was to the right, so Anthony pulled the brim of his hat low over his face, moved past him, and confident that the man hadn't seen him, edged backwards until his own back was pressed to the wall. Everyone faced the doors. Stirling, in front of him, was talking to someone he seemed to know. Anthony heard him murmur something about markets, a crisis in credit, the other man's muttered agreement. His own pulse was thumping in his ears and sweat trickled down his back. She held her bag in front of her with two gloved hands, her face composed, only a stray blonde strand of hair creeping down from her chignon to confirm that she was human, not some heavenly apparition.
"Second floor."
The doors opened, allowing two people out and one man in. The remaining passengers shuffled obligingly, making space for the new arrival. Stirling was still talking, his voice low and sonorous. It was a warm evening, and in the close confines of the lift, Anthony was acutely aware of the bodies around him, the smells of perfume, setting lotion, and brill cream that hung in the sticky air, the faint breeze as the doors closed. He lifted his head a little and stared at Jennifer. She was less than a foot away, so close that he could detect the spice of her scent and each tiny freckle on her shoulders. He kept staring until she turned her head a little and saw him. Her eyes widened, her cheeks coloured. Her husband was still deep in conversation. She looked at the floor, then her eyes slid back to Anthony's, the rise and fall of her chest revealing how much he'd shocked her. Their eyes met, and in those few silent moments, he told her everything. He told her that she was the most astonishing thing he had ever encountered. He told her she haunted his waking hours and that every feeling, every experience he had had in his life up to that point was flat and unimportant compared to the enormity of this. He told her he loved her.
Third floor.
She blinked, and they moved apart as a man at the back excused himself, walked between them and stepped out of the lift. As the gap closed behind him, Anthony reached into his pocket and retrieved the letter. He took a step to his right and held it out to her behind the evening jacket of a man who coughed, making them jump a little. Her husband was shaking his head at something his companion had said. Both men laughed humorlessly. For a moment, Anthony thought she wouldn't take it from him. But then her gloved hand shot out surreptitiously, and as he stood there, the envelope disappeared into her bag.
Fourth floor, said the bellboy. Restaurant.
Everyone except Anthony moved forwards. Sterling glanced to his right, apparently remembering his wife's presence, and reached out a hand, not in affection, Anthony observed, but to propel her forwards. The doors closed behind her, and he was alone as, with the bellboy's cry of, "Ground floor!" the lift began to descend. Anthony had barely expected a response. He hadn't even bothered to check his post until he left his house late and found two letters on the mat. He half walked, half ran along the baked, busy pavement, ducking in and out of the nurses and patients, leaving the vast St. Bartholomew's Hospital, his suitcase bashing against his legs. He was meant to be at Heathrow for 2:30, was barely sure even now how he would make it in time. The sight of her handwriting had induced a kind of shock in him, followed by panic when he realised it was already 10 to 12 and he was at the wrong end of London. Postman's Park, midday. There had, of course, been no taxis. He had jumped on a tube part of the way and run the rest. His shirt, neatly pressed, now stuck to his skin. His hair flopped over his sweaty forehead.
"Excuse me," he muttered,
as a woman in high-heeled sandals tutted, forced to step out of his way. "Excuse me!" A bus stopped, belching purple fumes, and he heard the conductor ring the bell for it to move off again. He hesitated as the passengers poured across the pavement, trying to catch his wind, and checked his watch. It was 12:15 already. It was entirely possible she would already have given up on him.
What the hell was he doing? If he missed this flight, Don would personally see to it that he was on golden weddings and other anniversaries for the next 10 years. They would view it as another example of his inability to cope. A reason to give the next good story to Murfitt or Phipps.
He ducked down King Edward Street, gasping, and then he was in a tiny oasis of peace in the middle of the city. The Postman's Park was a small garden created by a Victorian philanthropist to mark the lives of ordinary heroes. He walked, breathing hard, into the centre. It was blue, a gently moving swarm of blue. As his vision steadied, he saw postmen in their blue uniforms, some walking, some lying on the grass, a few lined up along the bench in front of the glazed Doulton tablets that commemorated each act of bravery. The postmen of London, freed from their rounds and postbags, were enjoying the midday sun in their shirt sleeves with their sandwich boxes, chatting, exchanging food, relaxing on the grass under the dappled shade of the trees. His breathing had steadied. He dropped his suitcase and fished for a handkerchief, mopped his forehead, then turned in a slow circle, trying to see behind the large ferns, the wall of the church, and into the shadowed enclaves of the office buildings. He scanned the park for a jewelled emerald dress, the flash of pale gold hair that would mark her out. She was not there. He looked at his watch. 20 past. She had come and gone. Perhaps she had changed her mind. Perhaps Sterling had found the ruddy letter. It was then that he remembered the second envelope, the one from Clarissa, which he had stuffed into his pocket as he left home. He pulled it out now and read it swiftly. He could never see her handwriting without hearing her tight, disappointed voice, or seeing her neat blouses, always buttoned to the neck, when she saw him, as if he might gain some advantage from a glimpse of her skin. "Dear Anthony, this is to let you know, as a matter of courtesy, that I am to be married. He felt a vague sense of proprietary shock at the idea that Clarissa might find happiness with someone else. He had thought her incapable of it with anybody. I have met a decent man who owns a chain of drapery shops, and he is willing to take on me and Philip. He is kind, and says he will treat him as his own. The wedding will be in September. This is difficult for me to broach, but you might want to think about how much contact you wish to maintain with the boy. I would like him to be able to live as a normal family, and it may well be that continued erratic contact with you will make it harder for him to settle. Please consider this, and let me know what you think. We will not require further financial assistance from you, as Edgar can provide for us. I enclose our new address below. Yours sincerely, Clarissa. He read it twice, but it was not until the third time that he grasped what she was proposing. Philip, his boy, should be brought up by some upright curtain merchant, free from his father's continued erratic contact. The day closed in on him. He felt a sudden urgent desire for alcohol, and saw an inn across the road through the park gates.
"Oh, Christ!" he said aloud, his hands dropping to his knees, his head sinking.
He stayed there, bent double for a minute, trying to collect his thoughts, to allow his pulse rate to return to normal. Then, with a sigh, he pushed himself upright. She was in front of him. She wore a white dress, patterned with huge red roses, and a pair of oversized sunglasses. She pushed them to the top of her head. A great sigh forced itself from his chest at the sheer sight of her.
"I can't stay," he began when he found his voice. "I've got to fly to Baghdad. My plane leaves in... Oh, I've no idea how..."
She was so beautiful, outshining the blooms in their neat borders, dazzling the postmen who had stopped talking to look at her.
"I don't..." He shook his head. "I can say it all in letters. Then when I see you, I..."
"Anthony," she said, as if she was affirming him to herself.
"I'll be back in a week or so," he said. "If you'll meet me then, I'll be able to explain. There's so much."
But she had stepped forward, and taking his face in her two gloved hands, pulled him to her. There was the briefest hesitation, and then her lips met his, her mouth warm, yielding yet surprisingly demanding. Anthony forgot the flight. He forgot the park and his lost child and his ex-wife. He forgot the story that his boss believed should have consumed him. He forgot that emotions in his experience were more dangerous than munitions. He allowed himself to do as Jennifer demanded, to give himself to her, to do it freely. "Anthony," she had said, and with that one word, had given him not only herself, but a new, better edited version of his future. We, over and out. Female, to Jeanette Winterson, via text message. Chapter 8. Once again he wasn't talking to her. For such an undemonstrative man, Lawrence Sterling's moods could be perversely mercurial. Jennifer eyed her husband silently over breakfast as he read his newspaper. Although she was downstairs before him, had laid out breakfast as he liked it, he had uttered, in the 33 minutes since he had first laid eyes on her that morning, not one word. She glanced down at her dressing gown, checked her hair. Nothing out of place. Her scar, which she knew disgusted him, was covered with her sleeve. What had she done? Should she have waited up for him? He had returned home so late the previous evening that she had been only briefly roused by the sound of the front door. Had she said something in her sleep? The clock ticked its melancholy way towards 8 o'clock, interrupted only by the intermittent rustle of Lawrence's newspaper as it was opened and refolded. Outside, she heard footsteps on the front steps, the brief rattle as the postman pushed the mail through the letterbox, then a child's voice lifted querulously as it passed the window. She attempted to make some remark about the snow, a headline about the increasing cost of fuel, but Lawrence merely sighed, as if in irritation, and she said no more. "My lover wouldn't treat me like this," she told him silently, buttering a piece of toast. "He would smile, touch my waist as he passed me in the kitchen. In fact, they probably wouldn't even have breakfast in the kitchen. He would bring a tray of delicious things up to bed, handing her coffee as she awoke, when they would exchange joyous, crummy kisses. In one of the letters he had written, 'When you eat, just for that moment you give yourself over entirely to the experience of it. I watched you that first time at dinner, and I wished you would give the same concentration to me.'" Lawrence's voice broke into her reverie. "It's drinks at the Moncriefs tonight before the company Christmas party. You do remember?"
"Yes."
She didn't look up. "I'll be back at around 6:30. Francis is expecting us then." She felt his eyes linger on her, as if he was waiting for some further response. But she felt too mulish to try. And then he was gone, leaving Jennifer to a silent house, and dreams of an imaginary breakfast far preferable to her own. "Do you remember that first dinner? I was such a fool, and you knew it. And you were so utterly, utterly charming, darling Jay, even faced with my ungracious behaviour. I was so angry that night. Now I suspect I was in love with you even then, but we men are so thumpingly incapable of seeing what's before us. It was easier to pass off my discomfort as something else entirely." She had now unearthed 7 letters from their hiding places around her house. 7 letters that laid out before her the kind of love she had known, the kind of person she had become as a result of it. In those handwritten words, she saw herself reflected in myriad ways, impulsive, passionate, quick to temper and to forgive. He seemed her polar opposite. He challenged, proclaimed, promised. He was an acute observer of her, of the things around him. He kept nothing hidden. She seemed to be the first woman he had ever truly loved. She wondered, when she read his words again, whether he was the first man she had truly loved in return. "When you looked at me with those limitless, deliquescent eyes of yours, I used to wonder what it was you could possibly see in me. Now I know that is a foolish view of love. You and I could no more not love each other than the earth could stop circling the sun." Although the letters were not always dated, it was possible to place them in some kind of chronology. This one had come soon after they had first met, another after some kind of argument, a third after a passionate reunion. He had wanted her to leave Lawrence. Several of them asked her to. She had apparently resisted. Why? She thought now of the cold man in the kitchen, the oppressive silence of her home. Why did I not go? She read the 7 letters obsessively, trawling for clues, trying to work out the man's identity. The last was dated September, a matter of weeks before her accident. Why had he not made contact? They had plainly never telephoned each other or had any specific meeting place. When she observed that some of the letters shared a P.O. box, she had gone to the post office to find out if there were any more. But the box had been reallocated, and there were no letters for her. She became convinced that he would make himself known to her. How could the man who had written these letters, the man whose emotions were suffused with urgency, just sit and wait? She no longer believed it might be Bill. It was not that she couldn't believe she'd had feelings for him, but the idea of deceiving Violet seemed beyond her, if not him. Which left Jack Amory and Reggie Carpenter. And Jack Amory had just announced his engagement to a Miss Victoria Nelson of Camberley, Surrey. Mrs. Cordoza entered the room as Jennifer was finishing her hair. "Could you make sure my midnight blue silk is pressed for this evening?" she said. She held a string of diamonds against her pale neck. He loved her neck.
"I've never yet been able to look at it without wanting to kiss the back."
"I've laid it out on the bed there." Mrs. Cordoza walked past her to pick it up.
"I'll do it now, Mrs. Sterling," she said.
Reggie Carpenter was flirting. There was no other word for it. Yvonne's cousin was leaning up against Jenny's chair. His eyes fixed on her mouth, which was twitching mischievously, as if they had shared a private joke. Yvonne watched them as she handed Francis a drink where he sat a few feet away. She stooped to murmur into her husband's ear, "Can't you get Reggie over with the men? He's been virtually sitting in Jennifer's lap since she got here."
"I tried, darling, but short of physically hauling him away, there wasn't a lot I could do."
"Then grab Maureen. She looks as if she's going to cry." From the moment she had opened the door to the Stirlings, Jennifer in a mink coat and apparently already loaded, he grim-faced, her skin had prickled, as if in anticipation of something awful. There was tension between them, and then Jennifer and Reggie had latched on to each other in a way that was frankly exasperating. "I do wish people would confine their quarrels to home," she muttered.
"I'll give Larry a large whiskey. He'll warm up eventually. Probably a bad day at the office."
Francis stood up, touched her elbow, and was gone. The cocktail sausages had hardly been tried. With a sigh, Yvonne picked up a plate of small eats and prepared to hand it around.
"Have one, Maureen."
Reggie's 21-year-old girlfriend barely registered that she had spoken. Immaculate in her rust-coloured wool dress, she was seated stiffly on a dining chair, casting dark looks at the two people to her right, both of whom seemed oblivious to her. Jennifer was leaning back in the armchair, while Reggie perched neatly on the arm. He whispered something and they burst into peals of laughter.
"Reggie," Maureen said, "didn't you say we were going into town to meet the others?"
"Oh, they can wait,"
he said dismissively.
"They were going to meet us in the green rooms, Bear. 7:30, you said."
"Bear?" Jenny, her laughter silenced, was staring at Reggie. "His nickname," said Yvonne, offering her the plate. "He was the most ridiculously hairy baby. My aunt said at first she thought she had given birth to one."
"Bear,"
Jenny repeated.
"Yup, I'm irresistible, soft, and never happier than when I'm tucked into bed."
He raised an eyebrow and leant closer to her.
"Reggie, can I have a word?"
"Not when you wear that face, dear cousin. Yvonne thinks I'm flirting with you, Jenny."
"Not just thinking it," said Maureen, coldly.
"Oh, come on, Mo, don't be a bore."
His voice, while still joking, held a note of irritation.
"I haven't had a chance to talk to Jenny for far too long. We're just catching up."
"Has it really been that long?"
Jennifer said innocently.
"Oh, an age," he said fervently.
Yvonne saw the girl's face fall. "Maureen, darling, would you care to come and help me make some more drinks? Goodness only knows where my useless husband has gone."
"He's just there. He..."
"Come on, Maureen. Through here."
The girl followed her into the dining room and took the bottle of creme de menthe Yvonne handed her. She radiated impotent fury.
"What does that woman think she's doing? She's married, isn't she?"
"Jennifer's just... oh, she doesn't mean anything by it."
"She's all over him. Look at her. How would she like it if I mooned at her husband like that?"
Yvonne glanced into the living room, where Larry, his face a mask of contained disapproval, was now sitting only half listening to what Francis was saying. She probably wouldn't notice, she thought.
"I know she's your friend, Yvonne, but as far as I'm concerned, she's an absolute bitch."
"Maureen, I know Reg is behaving badly, but you can't speak like that about my friend. You have no idea what she's gone through recently. Now, pass me that bottle, would you?"
"And what about what she's putting me through? It's humiliating. Everyone knows I'm with Reggie, and she's got him wrapped round her little finger."
"Jennifer had the most awful car crash. She's not very long out of hospital. Like I said, she's just letting her hair down a little."
"And her knickers with it."
"Mo,
she's drunk, and she's ancient. How old must she be, 27, 28? My Reggie's at least 3 years younger than she is."
Yvonne took a deep breath. She lit a cigarette, handed another to the girl, and pulled the double doors closed behind her.
"Mo, she's a thief. She's trying to steal him from me. I can see it, even if you can't."
Yvonne lowered her voice. "You have to understand, Mo, darling, that there's flirting and then there's
flirting. Reggie and Jenny are having a high old time together out there, but neither of them would ever think of cheating. They're flirting, yes, but they're doing it in a room full of people, not attempting to hide it. If there was the slightest seriousness in it, do you really think she'd be like that in front of Larry? It sounded convincing, even to herself. Darling girl, you will find as you get older that a bit of conversational parrying is part of life. She popped a cashew nut into her mouth. It's one of the great consolations for having to be married to one man for years and years. The girl scowled, but deflated a little. I suppose you're right, she said, but I still don't think it's a nice way for a lady to behave. She opened the doors and went back into the living room. Yvonne took a deep breath and followed her. The cocktails slid down as the conversation grew louder and livelier. Francis returned to the dining room and made more snowballs, while Yvonne deftly threaded cherries onto cocktail sticks to decorate them. She found now that she felt frankly dreadful if she had more than two proper drinks. So she had one made with blue curacao, then limited herself to Jaffa juice. The champagne was going down like no one's business. Francis turned off the music, in the hope that people might take the hint and leave. But Bill and Reggie turned it on again, and tried to get everyone to dance. At one point, both men had hold of Jennifer's hands, while they danced around her. As Francis was busy with the drinks, Yvonne took herself to where Lawrence was sitting and planted herself next to him. She had sworn to herself that she would get a smile out of him. He said nothing, but took a long swig of his drink, glanced at his wife and away again. Dissatisfaction radiated from him. "She's making a fool of herself," he muttered when the silence between them became too great. "She's making a fool of you," Yvonne thought. "She's just merry. It's been a strange time for her, Larry. She's trying to enjoy herself." When she looked at him, he was gazing at her intently. Yvonne felt a little uncomfortable. "Didn't you tell me the doctor said she might not be herself?" she added. He had told her this when Jennifer had been in hospital, back when he still talked to people. He took another swig of his drink, his eyes not leaving hers. "You knew, didn't you?"
"Knew what?"
His eyes strafed hers for clues. "Knew what, Larry?" Francis had put on a rumba. Behind them, Bill was entreating Jennifer to dance with him, and she was pleading with him to stop. Lawrence strained his glass.
"Nothing."
She leant forward and put a hand on his. "It's been tough on both of you. I'm sure you need a little time to..." She was interrupted by another peal of laughter from Jennifer. Reggie had put one of the cut flowers between his teeth and was engaging her in an impromptu tango. Lawrence shrugged her off delicately, just as Bill, breathless, flopped down beside them.
"That Reggie character's a bit much, isn't he? Yvonne, shouldn't you have a word?"
She dared not look at Lawrence, but his voice, when it came, was steady.
"Don't worry, Yvonne," he said, his eyes fixed somewhere in the far distance. "I'll sort it out."
She found Jennifer in the bathroom shortly before 8:30. She was leaning across the marble washbasin, retouching her makeup. Her eyes slid to Yvonne as she entered, then returned to her reflection. She was flushed, Yvonne noted, giddy almost.
"Would you like some coffee?" she said.
"Coffee?"
"Before you go on to Larry's works do."
"I think," Jennifer said, outlining her lips with an unusually careful hand, "for that shindig, I'm more likely to need another stiff drink."
"What are you doing?"
"I'm putting on my lipstick. What does it look like? I'm with my cousin. You're coming on awfully strong." It had come out more sharply than she had intended, but Jennifer seemed not to have noticed.
"When did we last go out with Reggie?"
"What?"
"When did we last go out with him?"
"I have no idea. Perhaps when he came to France with us in the summer."
"What does he drink, when he's not drinking cocktails?"
Yvonne took a deep, steadying breath.
"Jenny, darling, don't you think you should tone it down a little?"
"What?"
"This thing with Reggie. You're upsetting Larry."
"Oh, he doesn't care a fig what I do," she said dismissively. "What does Reggie drink? You must tell me. It's terribly important."
"I don't know. Whiskey? Jenny, is everything all right at home, with you and Larry?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"I'm probably talking out of turn, but Larry really does seem dreadfully unhappy."
"Larry does?"
"Yes. I wouldn't be too cavalier with his feelings, darling." Jenny turned to her.
"His feelings? Do you think anyone gives a damn what I've been through?"
"Jenny, I..."
"No one could care less. I'm just supposed to get on with it, keep my mouth shut and play the adoring wife, as long as Larry hasn't got a long face.
But if you want my opinion..."
"No, I don't. Just mind your own business, Yvonne. Really."
Both women stood very still. The air vibrated around them, as if a physical blow had been struck. Yvonne felt something tighten in her chest.
"You know, Jennifer, just because you can have any man in this house, it doesn't mean you have to."
Her voice was steely.
"What?"
Yvonne rearranged the towels on the rail.
"Oh, that helpless little princess shtick wears a bit thin sometimes. We know you're beautiful, Jennifer, yes? We know all our husbands adore you. Just have a care for other people's feelings for a change."
They stared at each other.
"Is that what you think of me? That I behave like a princess?"
"No, I think you're behaving like a bitch."
Jennifer's eyes widened. She opened her mouth as if to speak, then closed it, placed the top on her lipstick, straightened her shoulders and glared at Yvonne. Then she walked out. Yvonne sat down heavily on the lid of the lavatory and wiped her nose. She stared at the bathroom door, hoping it might open again, and when it didn't, her head sank into her hands. It was some moments later that she heard Francis's voice.
"You're right in here, old girl. I was wondering where you were. Darling?"
When she looked up, he saw the expression in her eyes and knelt swiftly, taking her hands.
"Are you all right? Is it the baby? Do you need me to do something?"
She gave a great shudder and allowed him to enfold her hands in his. They stayed where they were for some minutes, listening to the music and chatting downstairs. Then Jennifer's high-pitched laughter. Francis reached into his pocket and lit his wife a cigarette.
"Thank you."
She took it and inhaled deeply. Finally, she looked up at him, her dark eyes serious.
"Promise me we'll be happy even after the baby comes, Franny, darling."
"What's..."
"Just promise me."
"Now, you know I can't do that,"
he said, cupping her cheek.
"I've always prided myself on keeping you downtrodden and miserable."
She couldn't help but smile.
"Beast, I do my best."
He stood up and straightened the creases in his trousers.
"Look, I should imagine you're exhausted. I'll get this shower out of here and you and I can slope off to bed. How does that sound?"
"Sometimes," she said fondly as he offered a hand and she got to her feet. "You're not such a waste of a good wedding ring after all."
The air was cold and the pavement around the square almost empty. Alcohol had warmed her. She felt giddy, intoxicated.
"I don't suppose we'll get a taxi around here," Reggie said cheerfully, pulling up his collar. "What are you chaps going to do?"
His breath clouded in the night air.
"Larry has a driver."
Her husband was standing on the curb nearby, peering down the street.
"Except it looks as if he's disappeared."
She found this suddenly very funny, and fought to stop herself giggling.
"I gave him a night off," Lawrence muttered. "I'll drive. You stay here and I'll fetch the car keys."
He walked up the steps to their house. Jennifer wrapped her coat tightly around her. She couldn't stop staring at Reggie. It was him. Bear. It had to be. He had barely left her side all evening. She was sure there were hidden messages in many of the remarks he'd made.
"I haven't had a chance to talk to Jenny for ages."
There had been something in the way he'd said it. She was sure she hadn't imagined it. He drank whiskey. Bear. Her head was spinning. She'd drunk too much, but she didn't care. She had to know for sure.
We're going to be awfully late,
Reggie's girlfriend said mournfully, and Reggie cast a conspiratorial glance at Jennifer. He glanced at his watch.
Oh, we've probably missed them. They'll have gone on for a meal now.
So what will we do?
Who knows?
He shrugged.
Ever been to Alberto's club?
Jennifer said suddenly. Reggie's smile was slow and ever so slightly sly.
You know I have, Mrs. Sterling.
I do?
Her heart was thumping. She was amazed nobody else could hear it.
I believe I saw you at Alberto's the very last time I was there.
His expression was playful, mischievous almost.
Well, some night out this has been,
Maureen said petulantly, her hands thrust deep into the pockets of her coat. She glared at Jennifer as if she was to blame.
Oh, if only you weren't here,
Jennifer thought, her pulse racing.
Come with us,
she said suddenly.
What?
To Lawrence's party. It'll probably be deathly dull, but I'm sure you can liven it up a bit, both of you. There'll be lots to drink, she added.
Reggie looked delighted.
Count us in, he said.
Do I get a say in this?
Maureen's displeasure was written across her face.
Come on, Mo, it'll be fun. Otherwise it'll be just you and me in some dreary restaurant.
Maureen's despair showed in her eyes, and Jennifer felt a twinge of guilt, but hardened herself against it. She had to know.
Lawrence! She called. Lawrence, darling! Reggie and Maureen are going to come with us. Won't that be fun?
Lawrence hesitated on the top step, his keys in his hand, his gaze flicking between them.
Marvellous,
he said, walked steadily down the steps and opened the rear door of the big black car. Jennifer appeared to have undersold the potential for riotous behaviour at the Christmas celebrations of Acme Mineral and Mining. Perhaps it had been the decorations, or the copious amounts of food and drink, or even the prolonged absence of the boss. But when they arrived, the office party was in full swing. Someone had brought a portable gramophone. The lights were dimmed, and the desks had been moved to the side to create a dance floor, upon which a throng of people squealed and shimmied to Connie Francis.
"Larry, you never told us your staff were such hep cats,"
Reggie exclaimed. Jennifer left him standing in the doorway, gazing at the scene before him, as she joined the cluster of dancers. His feelings were written on his face. His place of work, his domain, his haven was unrecognizable to him, his staff no longer under his control, and he hated it. She saw his secretary rise from her chair, where she might have sat all evening, and say something to him. He nodded, attempting to smile.
"Drinks!"
Jennifer called, wanting to get as far from him as possible.
"Fight your way through, Reggie. Let's get sloshed."
She was dimly aware of a few looks of surprise as she passed her husband's staff, many of whom had loosened their ties, their faces flushed with drink and dancing. Their eyes went from her to Lawrence.
"Hello, Mrs. Sterling."
She recognized the accountant who had spoken to her in the office a couple of weeks previously and smiled at him. His face was shiny with sweat, and he had an arm around a giggling girl in a party hat.
"Why, hello. You couldn't show us where the drinks are, could you?"
"Over there, by the typing pool."
A huge vat of punch had been made. Paper cups were being filled and handed over people's heads. Reggie handed her one, and she drank the contents in one, laughing when its unexpected potency made her cough and splutter. Then she was dancing, lost in a sea of bodies, dimly aware of Reggie's smile, his hand occasionally touching her waist. She saw Lawrence watching her impassively from the wall, then, apparently reluctantly, engaged in conversation with one of the older, more sober men. She didn't want to be anywhere near him. She wished he would go home and leave her there to dance. She didn't see Maureen again. It was possible the girl had left. Things blurred, time stretched, became elastic. She was having fun. She felt hot, raised her arms above her head, let herself ride the music, ignoring the other women's curiosity. Reggie spun her around and she laughed uproariously. God, but she was alive. This was where she belonged.
It was the first time she hadn't felt alien in a world that everyone insisted was hers.
Reggie's hand touched hers, shocking and electric. His glances at her had become meaningful, his smile knowing. Bear. He was mouthing something at her.
What?
She pushed a sweaty lock of hair off her face.
It's hot. I need another drink.
His hand felt radioactive on her waist. She followed close behind him, camouflaged by the bodies around them. When she glanced behind her for Lawrence, he had vanished. Probably to his office, she thought. In it the light was on. Lawrence would hate this. He hated fun of any kind, her husband. Sometimes these last weeks, she had wondered if he even hated her. Reggie was thrusting another paper cup into her hand.
Air! He shouted. I need some air!
And then they were out in the main hallway, just the two of them, where it was cool and silent. The sounds of the party faded as the door closed behind them.
Here,
he said, steering her past the lift to a fire escape.
Let's go out on the stairs.
He wrestled with the door, and then they were in the chill night air, Jennifer gulping it as if to quench a great thirst. Below them she could see the street, the odd car's brake lights.
I'm soaked, he pulled at his shirt, and I have absolutely no idea where I left my jacket.
She found herself staring at his body, now clearly outlined by the damp fabric, and made herself look away.
Fun, though,
she murmured.
I'll say. Didn't see old Larry dancing.
He doesn't dance, she said, wondering how she could say this with such certainty. Ever. They were quiet for a moment, staring out into the darkness of the city. In the distance they could hear traffic, and behind them the muffled sounds of the party. She felt charged, breathless with anticipation.
Here.
Reggie took a packet of cigarettes from his pocket and lit one for her.
I don't.
She stopped herself. What did she know? She might have smoked hundreds.
Thank you,
she said. She took it gingerly between two fingers, inhaled and coughed. Reggie laughed. I'm sorry, she said, smiling at him. I appear to be hopeless at it.
Go on anyway. It'll make you light-headed.
I'm already light-headed.
She felt herself colour a little.
Proximity to me, I'll wager,
he said, grinning and taking a step closer to her.
I wondered when I'd get you alone.
He touched the inside of her wrist.
It's pretty hard speaking in code with everyone else around.
She wondered if she'd heard him correctly. Yes, she said, when she could speak, and her voice was filled with relief.
Oh, God, I wanted to say something earlier. It's been so difficult. I'll explain later, but there was a time... Oh, hold me. Hold me, Bear. Hold me.
Glad to.
He took another step forward and put his arms around her, pulling her close to him. She said nothing, just trying to absorb how it felt to be in his arms. He brought his face to hers, and she closed her eyes, ready, breathing in the male scent of his sweat, feeling the unexpected narrowness of his chest, wanting to be transported. Oh, but I've waited so long for you, she told him silently,